Can we hear?
There we go.
We're in Exodus chapter 8. I think Scott left off around verse 15. We're going to start with the lice here this morning. Andy Swiffer is going to approach God in prayer for us and start our class out and help us focus on spiritual things, get our minds separated from the eggs and bacon and matching socks and all those important things this morning. We may have some visitors this morning. We're starting our series of gospel meetings, so we're thankful if you're here. We're going through a study of Exodus over this quarter and talking about the mighty wonders that God showed Egypt, showed His own children, and how He made a great nation and began fulfilling of the, one of the three promises to His future nation and people. If you'll be at Acts chapter 8, Andy, lead us in prayer and we'll begin our study for the morning. Before we begin, we may having some visitors. We'll go back with just a brief review. I was in Chicago Wednesday night and unable to be here for the study, so we covered the first three or four plagues. And Scott tells me that he went over the gods of Egypt, or some of the gods of Egypt, and listed on those kind of how they would help us understand the significance of what God showed these people and reflect of His greatness. We talked about the various names of God, Lord, Jehovah, I Am. What was one of the other ones? I didn't even think that far back in my notes. Say it louder. Elohim. And there was one more I was looking for. Boy, if I could read my own notes, we'd be in great shape, you know. Yeah, Shaddai. Yeah, El Shaddai. Yeah, that was what I was thinking of. Thank you. I needed that. We covered that. How did you guys deal Wednesday night? Somebody give me in a nutshell this idea, because we're going to be dealing with it over and over and over again. Did Pharaoh harden his own heart, or did God harden his heart? Tell me something about that. Who wants to volunteer for that? Freddie, tell me about that. This hardening of the heart. Did you guys explain it in simple terms? I think that's a good job for it to be thrown on you without expecting it that way. I had a quote from somewhere. I had it in the margin of my Bible. The sun that melts the butter hardens the clay. The same God in the same behavior. And even as we saw, God opened Lydia's heart in Acts chapter 16. The same God doing the same things. And we react to it differently. And God knew how Pharaoh would behave. And we see the arrogance of this king and the greatest power in the world at that time had been raised to be God to his people. For him to be humbled before this God that he did not know of shepherds and goat herders was just so beneath him that we're going to see a few times today where he will succumb to the pressure either of his own inconvenience or aggravation, the nuisance effect, or of the pressures that were put on him by his people, and he would acknowledge God and then harden his heart again. So right, God was active in this process. I mean, he presented the temptation before him or the situation to him, and this the same act that melts the butter, the same effort on his part hardens the clay. It has different effects. So God hardened his heart in the sense that he put the ordained conditions in front of him, and Pharaoh elected to resist them. He had a stubborn streak, didn't he? But he had a choice. He elected to behave this way. And we're going to see this over and over again. And in truth, we see it in our own lives, don't we? I mean, we come to a moment where we are humbled and we're convicted of our sin. And we kneel and, well, I'll never do this again. And what do? We do it again. Far too often, we harden our hearts and our hearts can be hardened to the point where we can't be recovered. It is the effect of some that behave in sin for so long it would appear that we're not recoverable. Here is God uses this condition and this characteristic of Pharaoh to display His mighty works. We may have talked about this last week, but I think I mentioned the fact that God could have ended this, and He's going to state a similar statement in this morning's lesson, that He could have just slain them all. That Egypt could have just been ended. He could have taken His people out by force. There would have been no discussion about it. There would have been no offer for compromise. There would have been no changes of mind. But God elected not to do that. And why did He not do that? Why did God not elect just to take charge and take those people out of there without question? All the world would know of this, wouldn't they? Because of who Egypt was and because of who the Pharaoh was, and to come in and remove those people under great blight, some major tragedy, it could have been explained away as a tsunami in Japan. It could have been explained away as a class 5 tornado that came through Alabama, and it just happened. But God did not allow that explaining away of the situation, that He gave them, some historians think, as long as a year for this to unfold and for Pharaoh to have choices and to refuse those choices and for all of these mighty works and these wonders to be shown and expressed and to be told and retold to their children and their grandchildren and the nations round about them and by us even today. Let's read verses 16 through 19. Jake, can you read that for us? Chapter 8 of Exodus, verses 16, and we'll start with lice this morning. And it's just 4 or 5 verses there. 16 through 19. Give me some thoughts here with respect to the fact that the magicians had been brought forth even from the very initial signs that were given. Even the rod, when it was thrown down and became a snake, the magicians threw theirs down, and they were able to, in some manner, duplicate or simulate these marvelous acts. And here, for the first time, we see they were unable to do this. Give me some thoughts here. Did you discuss the ability of the magicians to perform these miracles, and now they couldn't? Anybody got any thoughts on that? I think so, and I think here in this, they were able to pull something off, even in their own confidence. I think it says something, not that the Bible says that they were able to do something like this, but they were willing to do it, and they continued to do it because these were tricksters. They were able to say, I think I can do one like that. I think I can pull that off. Give me a shot in the batter's box. They come in and they pull something off, and it was enough to appease the Pharaoh for him to back off. But they get to the lice. I even wondered when they came up and these frogs are coming out, they come in, and maybe their effort was, it would have been no small feat to come out and I made some frogs come out. Well, they were coming out anyway. I don't know how that was distinguished from one miracle to the next, but if I'd have been there, I'd have been stopping some frogs. I mean, that would have been my agenda, to get the frogs out of my bed. And they were able to, by sleight of hand, by slickness of word, by something, to give enough of a sign that there was some convincing, at least to Pharaoh. But when we get to the lice here, they were unable to do anything similar. Their sleight of hand, their trickery, whatever it was that they had been using before, we're down to the third plague here, and they can't do it. And their response to Pharaoh was what? For real. I can't do this one. This is the real thing. We need to move on. We need to work out an arrangement here. They were not able to duplicate this. We're going to see also in this one, and going on to the plague of the flies, that these earlier plagues were more of an inconvenience. They were more of a nuisance. These things weren't the tragedy to the land or the people. What else is something that we see that's unique about the first four plagues relative to the Israelites and the Egyptians? They came on both of them. Now explain that to me. I mean, this is God's chosen people, and He's putting frogs in their bed. Anybody got any thoughts on that? In the following plagues, He's going to make a separation. Up until now, He's elected not to make a change. But there's some thought given to the fact that the Israelites needed some impressing too. This is highly abnormal. This wasn't a routine seasonal change in something that could have been explained away, even for His own people, that with their resistance to following Aaron and Moses and some of the things that we've already seen. Keep in mind that they've been in bondage, and they have been impressed by these magicians and by these gods up here for 250 to 400 years. I have to think about that every time I engage in this study. The length of time, 250, 400 years, 400 years. We're back to Columbus days or something like that, the Mayflower. I mean, this would be a part of their lives just as much as anything that we understand here in a 200 year nation of the United States, that we're here forever. We are the power of the world. No one can resist us. And they're in the shadow of the strongest nation in the world, and they would have been humbled before this great nation. So there's some explaining to do that the Lord is doing for these people to prepare them for the change that they are to undergo. He had to impress them, and as much as He did impress them, He failed to impress some of them, didn't He? We are believers. We sit here this morning as believers, and yet we behave ourselves in ways that are unseemly at times. We are so harsh on these people to see, if I saw what they saw, I wouldn't have those problems. I wouldn't behave that way, but yet we do. We do. What is the, give me some thoughts here as far, did you notice, I guess, there was no warning here of the lice. Did you notice the other ones that there was a warning and he would go down to the river? And I have this image of the Nile River as being the center focal point of that nation. It was everything to them. We're going to see in a minute the lack of rain that they had in a year. They had the Nile. It fed them. It sustained them. It was their transportation. It was everything to them. And he walks down on the river's edge and he talks to Pharaoh and his servants. And he would warn them about what was about to take place if you don't let my people go. But this one, he didn't warn them. Any thoughts of why a change in the routine here? He didn't even warn them. He just threw lice on them. Any ideas? All of this is speculation. Maybe because he had agreed to let them go with the frogs, and then he reneged. He lied. I mean, okay, you're going to play that game. You're going to tell me you're going to do something. Well, let's just go on to number four. And he did. Without warning, he put the lice on them and increased, stepped up the heat just a little bit. Again, there's nothing, there's some discussion about whether they were lice, whether they were real lice, what type of bugs. They were some kind of biting bug. You know, I've had fleas before. They're not good, but I didn't die from it. And this was a pestilence. It was terrible. I mean, the frogs, I'm sorry, ladies, but I've eaten them before. They're bad, but you're not going to die from a frog in your bed. These were bad things, but they're not anything to measure what we're coming up on as things with each plague step up from the entire nation, including the Israelites, to now just the Egyptians, to not just bothering the Egyptians, but beginning to kill the Egyptians and change their way of life. In verse 20 of chapter 8, the plague of the flies, and the Lord tells Moses to rise up and go forth again to the water and stand for him, a place that he was known to go maybe every morning to bathe or to worship as the sun god Ra would come up over this body of water, but it was known where he would be. Moses was to meet him and to tell him to let my people go. And in verse 22, in that day, or I will sever in that day the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarm of flies shall be there to the end that thou may knowest. I am the Lord in the midst of the earth, and I will put a division between my people and the people, and tomorrow shall this be a sign. So now we have for the first time that he is he's isolating his people, and he's, again, a greater sign to say this isn't a natural calamity that's befalling a geography. But it has separation for my people to know that I am their God and I am not your God until you believe. He acquiesced. He said you can go. And what language does someone else's version use? In 28, the Pharaoh said, "I will let you go that you may sacrifice to your God in the wilderness. Only ye shall not go very far away. Entreat for me." Somebody else use anything other than entreat? Intercede for me? Plead for him? Something's beginning to change, isn't it? You're the greatest man in the world. And he said, could you throw a prayer in there for me? As we negotiate this deal, see if he'll take this offer. Entreat for me. We're already beginning to see, and I think this is a major step for a guy that had grapes dropped in his mouth and palm leaves fanned at him and all these things to be bathed and never have to do a lick of work. And in verse 29, and Moses said, "Behold, I go out from thee, and I will entreat the Lord that the swarm of flies may depart from Pharaoh and his servants and his people tomorrow, but let not Pharaoh deal deceitfully any more." And not letting the people go to sacrifice. Why would he have thrown this caveat in there? Why would he say, "But don't be deceitful now"? He'd already done it once, hadn't he? He'd already done it once, and he was telling him that don't be deceitful with it. We're aware of this, and this is not going to go on. And so the Lord did according to the word of Moses. He removed the swarms, and Pharaoh hardened his heart at this time also. Neither would he let the people go. The plague on the cattle, in chapter 9. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go in unto Pharaoh and tell him, Thus saith the Lord God of the Hebrews, Let my people go that they may serve me. For if thou refuse to let them go and wilt hold them still, behold, the hand of the Lord is upon my cattle which is in the field, upon the horses, upon the asses, upon the camels, upon the oxen, and upon the sheep. There shall be very grievous murrain, and the people shall sever between the cattle of Israel and the cattle of Egypt, and there shall nothing die of all that is the children of Israel's. And the Lord appointed a set time, saying, Tomorrow the Lord shall do this thing in the land. And the Lord did that thing on the tomorrow, and all the cattle of Egypt died, but the cattle of the children of Israel died not one. And Pharaoh sent, and behold, there was not one cattle of the Israelites dead. And the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he let not the people go." There's this would have been one of their primary gods, the bull, the bull of Apis, and to see. Did anybody give any thought? These were stupid people, right? The Egyptians, I mean, they're worshiping lies, right? Were these stupid people? These were engineering marvels of the world. Even today, their edifices and their architecture are known. I struggle with. Has anybody ever talked to a Hindu before? Anybody talked to the folks that I guess worship their ancestors in cattle form? I have a hard time understanding this. I mean, put these creatures up any more than the Philistines, the Canaanites, and their wood and their stone and those things that they worshipped. But in the conquering of the land of Canaan, I always had drugs and things that were involved to make the people crazy to sacrifice their children to the fire. I can't get a grip on worshiping a toad. I can't make sense out of people that are this intelligent, but when I am arrives on the scene, there's a distinct difference, isn't it? Anybody make any sense out of the culture of people and the nature of people to worship things that way? I can't. And it wasn't too far before they were not only carrying them with them, but they were building their own, weren't they? So the things that we tried to dismiss and the things that we don't understand, but why would they be so seduced? What's an explanation for even the Israelites to do that? It comes back to me of the years and the years and the years of influence that they couldn't get out of their system. The influence of those around us, and I'll tell you, I try to bring lessons in, not just from a historical perspective for us to understand this Israelite nation that's coming and these Egyptians that we don't understand, but let me tell you, people, we are influenced by our surroundings today. I mean, who we hang with and who we elect to spend our time with and the activities that we do and what we do aside from this building and these few hours that we spend together in a week, they affect us. And you can deny it, but you'll see it generationally in families and the following generation and the results of the children of having our surroundings become a part of us. And once it starts, it is hard to break. We need to be conscious of this. We need to see stories like this and seeing Abraham's seed building a molten calf. Abraham's seed battling, do I worship the lice or do I worship, which one do I? They were being convinced. They had bought into this to some degree, to some people. This isn't 75 people anymore. Millions of people. Millions of Israelites here. And to keep the family relationship, the unity of what Abraham started 400 years earlier, Very, very difficult. But no more, no less difficult, I think, than the challenge that faces every one of the families that are represented in this auditorium this morning, for us to guide our families and to control the influences around them and to make a stand, be different, make a decision every day, every hour, every practice, every game that comes in conflict with the gospel meeting time. Every one of those decisions makes an impact on our children, and they're going to make that impact on their children and say, it really doesn't matter. That's not that important. I've made a commitment to these people. I'm talking about the ball team. I need to do this kind of thing, and we're making a statement. And here the Israelites had been affected by frogs and lies. As ridiculous that is, we are impacted and we carry on that torch every day, every year here. It really does. I hadn't thought of that aspect of the. We've got to believe. I mean, we've got all of the evidence there, but we selectively pick things that rationalize things to our intellect. And I've got a lesson I've never delivered about people that I grew up with that I thought were the salt of the earth. I mean, they were the finest people I ever met, dated some of them, hung around some of them. And today they don't darken the building. They're not faithful. They're not a member of any congregational family. Their children are gone. They're on their third marriage. How can that be? I know people that the most intelligent people, as intelligent one I've got in mind is just the sharpest guy I ever met. He could argue his way through and made a sport of arguing and debating. And if somebody knew the truth, he knew the truth. He's not faithful anymore. That intellect does not play upon it. Faith is what we're looking for. Faith, an understanding faith, an educated faith. But we can just get too smart for our own britches, can't we? We can get too smart for our own britches. Number six, the plague of the boils. Some have thought that this may have been anthrax. This begins beyond the first three plagues and the nuisances, and then we involve their chief bull god Apis. Now we're down to infecting them personally, aren't they? I mean, I like sci-fi movies, anthrax, is you just don't even mention anthrax. I mean, that's terrible. We don't know if this was anthrax, but it was a blister, it was a boil, it was a blain. It would pop up as God told Moses what to do, and he took the dust and he threw it in the air, and the dust became as particulate in the land, and it covered everything, and it festered and made blisters on their skin, and they were broken out all over with pus and boils and blisters and painful, so much so that who could not stand before Moses after this plague? The magicians themselves, the ones that had already seen the finger of God involved in this and understood this, I can't reproduce this. This is not trickery. This is the real thing. And now they are laid up in bed. They are in dark places covered by blankets and poultices and suffering. God has elevated the intensity of the plagues now so that it is affecting them personally. It's affecting, verse 10, and they took ashes of the furnace and stood before Pharaoh and Moses and sprinkled it upward, and it became a boil breaking forth with blains, which is blisters, upon man and upon beast. And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, because the boil was on the magicians and upon the Egyptians. And the Lord hardened his heart of Pharaoh, and he hearkened unto him as the Lord had spoken unto Moses. Terrible, terrible thing. This would have gotten it down on a personal level. The seventh plague, hail. Not having studied this in a long time, and I think of hail. It's hail. You know, I mean, it was just hail. We had a little hail in April. Turn to Psalms chapter 78. Justin, read. Did you guys read this Wednesday night? If you read, I like David's words here in verse 42. Psalms chapter 78. And we're getting down some graphic language to me, or at least getting our mind's eye involved in what they saw down in verse 49. Read 42 through 50. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamore trees with frost, and he gave up their cattle unto the hail and their flocks to hot thunderbolts. April 21st, 27th, when the tornadoes came through, the insurance agents know the date well. I had a salesman left the office, and he was traveling from the square to Holland East. And he called and said, "You've never seen anything like this. I mean, we were watching the lightning, but the lightning came and it didn't just hit, and it was everywhere, and it crept on the ground. Terrifying. Something probably unique about this plague was just the climate of Egypt would have made this a traumatic, terrifying. We have in the state of Alabama somewhere around 50 inches of rainfall a year. I think they've got 4 to 8, maybe. I mean, we have a few inches in a day on a Saturday. The hail would come. The frost on the sycamore trees. You remember the change difference between a front? There's no need to make anything natural understandable out of this, but I've been in a storm where it was either just blistering hot out there and all of a sudden you were chilly after the storm came through. These images and these thoughts of things that I've experienced, and I don't have a good healthy terror of tornadoes the way I should, and growing in my respect for them. But this would have terrorized these people. It would have been so different and so unique to anything that they saw, as with the lice, but they were lice. They were frogs, and here we've got lightning that's creeping on the ground and slaying everything in its path and killing the cattle and killing man or beast. He gave them the option. What was something that was unique about the setting of and the preparation for this plague with regards to giving the Egyptians a chance? And more of a general said, don't just let my people go, but what advice was given to them? About their cattle. Carry them inside, you know. And evidently from the language used here that there were beginning to be believers among them, it seems as though some took their possessions in, that they gathered together, that this is not magicians over in Tanis and some Python or some town of Egypt, that this was covering the entire land, and people began to recognize that Jehovah is among us. Let's gather our things up or we're going to die. This is not a political event that happens in Washington, D.C. This is in my house. This is going to affect my livelihood. And it says that some of the Egyptians gathered their things together. In chapter 11, verse 3, once all of this plays out, chapter 11, verse 3, "And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt and in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and the sight of the people." That these events were being noticed beyond a spectacle that was being provided to Pharaoh to let my people go. There was a nation that was being educated here. There was an empire that was being affected by Jehovah, and they recognized God's agent here, didn't they? There was an appreciation for Moses that when Moses speaks, it something happens. It really happens. And so Moses' fame throughout the land, now, no telling what rumors had been started and what was thought of Moses from 40 years ago when he left in shame for slaying an Egyptian, but he's back now, and there would have been spin, there would have been explanation to explain this guy away and what his motives were and what the plan was, and now the Egyptians, this is a man of God. He has returned and he is exposing to us his God and Jehovah. This would have been scary. In verse 26, we have, this is the third time now that Israel has been isolated from it. And how does Pharaoh react this time? He has fainted or feigned his concessions before, and he's called him Lord. You know, you guys go and deal with your Lord, but he talks about God in more of a personal way now. James Craig, read 27 and 28 for us. Now it's a God that he recognizes, doesn't it? Now it's a God that I have sinned. Jehovah, Yahweh, is righteous, and I and my people are wicked. Pray for me. This was a terrorized Pharaoh. This was beginning to have the effect that would have had on me with the first plague, I guess. But because of his arrogance and because of his greatness, he's confessing sin before a God that he's never heard of before. Any thoughts about this situation? Yep. Mike Bryant? I thought you had a...
It's just about, you know, when you talk about the hell in verses 15, 16, 17, you know, what you start the class is, if it had put out his hand and struck you in the people of testimony, you would have been cut off from earth and you could just take him out. But for the purpose I raised up to kill you my power, my name may be proclaimed on earth, and says, you are still exalting yourself against my people. And that was re-emphasized.
Absolutely. Did Moses expect this to do it? Did Moses, when he said, "I have sinned," I mean, we're on the front pew and we meet with the preacher and we're in tears and we confess our sin and we're to accept somebody's confession here. And I may be going way too far into this, but Moses got some insight here. He just said, "It'll be okay. We're good. We're all over. I'll get rid of it. Everything's done." How did Moses react to Pharaoh's confession? "You don't fear God. You don't fear yet. Yeah, you're not a believer." In verse 30, But as for thee and thy servants, I know that ye will not fear the Lord God. We're not. You've lied to me. You've lied to me. The evidence is that we got some more raising to do here. And sure enough, there's three more plagues that we'll deal with starting in chapter 10 Wednesday night. Appreciate your attention. Hope this is good for you. And appreciate your comments. We'll pick up in chapter 10 Wednesday night. I guess, or will we? Do we have class Wednesday night? He's going to teach you? No class Wednesday night. I'll pick up chapter 10.